Hello, everybody. Oh, thanks, Rick. No, it's all right. Hello, everybody. I'm glad we're here. It may seem like a vendor pitch because I do work for Vernier, and Vernier is a NAC vendor, but it's really not. So don't worry. I'm probably actually going to bash NAC as much as I am going to praise it, because I want to at least try to be somewhat honest about what it is that NAC is and what specifically what it isn't. And the talk here is, when I say beyond NAC, I'm talking about the idea of taking NAC, deploying it, and how you're going to have to think beyond what it can and cannot do to continue to solve problems, because while it is a good tool, it's not necessarily the be-all, end-all that most marketing departments at NAC vendors claim it is. So roughly what we're going to cover in here is we're going to have some basic information. I'm going to talk about a few issues that, by the way, just has anyone here deployed NAC? I would have been surprised to see, I got some kind of like this, and that's about it. I would be very surprised to see that. It's weird, too, because Vernier has a lot of customers. Some of them are doing NAC. Some of them have some of the older products they used to have. And we've got about a third of the market, and then Cisco has another third, and then the rest. So we could say, depending on who you ask, we're either number one or number two, which means that Cisco sold four boxes, we've sold four boxes, and everyone else is still trying to sell a box. There's really not seeing hardly any acceptance at all. And we'll kind of touch in on that, what I think are some of the reasons why. I'll cover some of the issues after you may deploy it, and then talk about what I call next steps. It's kind of a look past what the capabilities are of most NAC systems. And it's especially interesting considering, because I really enjoyed some of the autonomic networking stuff that's been discussed, like yesterday. I found that pretty interesting because it kind of more or less ties in where it looks like things are heading. And then we'll do Q&A, and you can ask during the Q&A. We can talk NAC, we can talk security, whatever you want to do, okay, for as long as you want until about the time I want to go home, since I do live in the area. All right, so we'll start off with why you should actually even care about NAC to begin with. First off, it is maturing. It's actually coming along quite nicely. Vernier started out doing NAC stuff before it was considered NAC, because they're doing wireless, and wireless authentication and that kind of stuff is very similar to NAC in many respects. You're authenticating before allowing access onto a network. And there literally are dozens of competitors. And it hasn't reached that stage. Most of the time you have like some area where you have 20 vendors, and then eventually they all start like buying each other out and consolidating. Some fall off the map. And then it kind of becomes more of a commodity kind of thing when you end up with just like, three or four major players in it. Well, we're still at the 20 vendor spot at this point in the industry. But it is coming along. There's a lot of corporations that are either evaluating it or considering it. They're thinking, okay, should we do this, should we not? They're at least trying to take a look at it. And, of course, probably the biggest reason is because all the marketing people are probably hitting your sea levels, saying, hey, like your Gartners and these type of people are talking to the C-level people at your company saying, oh, you need to pay attention to this because you're paying me a fee and I want to keep you engaged. So here's a bunch of buzzwords, here's a bunch of charts, and go NAC, and then you're left with this mess trying to explain, what the hell did that guy say to you, and why do I have to put this crap in my environment? So basically, even if you're dead set against deploying it, you may want to know about it just for that reason alone, as to why the CIO or CTO thinks it's a good idea. All right, what it is and what it isn't. Okay, first off, it is a way of regulating and controlling access to the network. Specifically, it happens, ideally it happens when the machine comes up and they try to do anything on the network. They have to do some type of authentication before they're allowed access to the network. It also is kind of a way of enforcing policy on the endpoints before they come on. So you could say, okay, I don't want anyone on my network unless they're running this version of the operating system, this patch level, they've got antivirus, and it's turned on, and it's up to date, and they've got spyware, anti-spyware stuff on there, and it's up to date, et cetera, et cetera. Whatever the policy is that you expect to have on these machines, then there you go. That's what you want to have more or less enforced by the by a NAC product. It is not a security solution. A lot of vendors will try to sell it as a security solution. It is not a security solution in its own. Okay, it is an enhancement to all the other things that you're doing security-wise. It's also not a policy solution. That's another big thing that that people do, because you know most of us here have to deal with some type of policies in dealing with computers, and we know it's not all specifically related to gaining access to the network and whatnot. There's other elements involved in that as well. Everything from physical to security to whatever. So, but there are some security and policy implications in NAC that they're not going to seem quite obvious at first. And I'll go through some scenarios and we'll cover a few things, and hopefully it'll make it a little more obvious. Okay, all right. This is basically where, you know, if you're looking at NAC, this is the kind of thing where NAC should be at. Okay. Now this one we refer to as the VP at the airport scenario, because you don't want everything just to be black and white. Like, oh, I'm not letting you on the network because you've got to download the latest patch from Microsoft. I'm not letting you on the network because you don't have, you know, whiz-bang doodad agent running that does something stupid on your system. You don't want to do that kind of thing. And so what happens is the VP at the airport, you got the VP of sales, for example. He's at the airport. He's not a computer guy, okay? He's a sales guy. And we'd like to think that, you know, for your company, maybe he's actually, that's his expertise, being the VP. I would hope so. But nonetheless, is you're thinking, okay, this guy's at the airport. He's got 15 minutes before a flight. He's trying to close a deal. He needs to get onto the network to look up a price of something or send off that, you know, all-important email. He's going to close the big deal that's going to make, you know, it's going to be, let's say it's a seven-figure deal, okay? You don't want it to be a scenario where he can't get onto the network because his box is infected with something. Now, you're saying as an admin, I don't want this guy on my network, because last night in the hotel room, he's looking at porn, online gambling, and so he's got all this crap on the laptop that we gave him. And, you know, he just turned off everything that was causing the alert. He knew how to do that. He turned off his antivirus. He turned off everything else because it kept popping up every time he hit that porn site. Okay? So now he's got this infected laptop, and he's trying to get on it, but he's got to complete the big sale. Now, from a business perspective, what are your choices here? You can... And this is typically the way people think of NAC, is that should I let them on and close the deal and we get seven figures? Or, but at the same time, if I let him on, he may do seven figures worth of damage to the network. Maybe, maybe not. Is everyone else up to date? You know, are you going to sit there and weigh that while you're on the phone with the guy who's yelling at you saying, let me on the damn network, you know, I'm trying to close this deal. So ideally, the way this should work is that you're able to let him onto the network and he has access to those resources he needs to complete his deal. But his laptop is not going to proceed to pollute your network with his ill-begotten malware. Okay, that you actually are shutting down the malware accessing the network, but you're not shutting down him sending the email or, you know, getting the numbers that he needs to complete the deal. So that's basically that's one of the things where it should be. The other one is that you should be in line, and you should be fast. All the NAC vendors that are actually making sales are in line. The ones that are going into the large shops are the ones that are in line. You know, for example, the latency is under a millisecond. You know, we're in the microsecond range. It's got to be fast, okay? Because normally, what you're doing is like, you know, if you've got we include an IPS in our system as well, and you can run it kind of in an IDS mode if you want. But the thing is you've got to be reacting to things that are happening real time on the traffic, and then be able to react accordingly, particularly when you're enforcing policy and things like that. You need to be able to react real time as it's happening, and be able to like shut things down that shouldn't be happening or whatnot. You can't wait until they've connected up to some device and they've sent the bad packet that's going to do the evil and say, oh, we should have caught that. Or, oh, guess what? Something bad just went that way. Okay? You should be able to say, oh, here's something bad. I see it coming in the device. I'm not going to let it out the other end. Okay? So being in line really helps. And this also applies to, you know, just the fact that you're trying to, particularly if you've got like a huge amount of users, they're going to be logging into the network, because this is the way a lot of NAC systems work, is that they will sniff authentication onto some other system. So if they're doing LDAP or 802.1x, whatever authentication method is being used, they sniff that, and from the sniffing of that, they're able to say, "Ah, that's Fred. He's logging in, and I'm seeing it. So I'm going to seamlessly allow him access" to things he wants to see, or things he needs to get to do his job. So it's one thing if you can handle it when Fred logs in, but if Fred and, 3,000 of his coworkers all log in at 8 o'clock, you need something that's going to be capable of catching all this without dropping any packets in real time. Okay, so the thing has got to be blindingly fast. Okay? And also, like, I know there's some NAC vendors who are not in line that are going to do things like we're going to just capture all the DHCP type traffic, and it's all your end users got to do is just assign himself an IP address, and then they're flying right under the radar, and so you're not even able to track them, that kind of thing. If you're doing, an IDS IPS, it has to be state of the art. It cannot be an add-on. So being able to do really cool things like, DCE RPC fragmentation reassembly on the fly, un-gzip, gzipped web traffic on the fly, that's the kind of stuff that needs to be able to happen at unbelievably blazing speeds so that you can look and see if something bad is happening. So the thing has to be extremely fast. It can't just be like, oh, we're a NAC vendor, we're going to go ahead and just add on, this IPS component because it's going to, make us better than some other guy. It actually has to really work. And it should work for the, you can't look at our data departments in a company. I used to work at Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad. They're based actually over in Fort Worth. And we had a legal department that had, and you guys have probably encountered this, and it's the oddball strange request that came out of, nowhere that makes absolutely no sense. They say, we want you to manage our systems, but you cannot touch our boxes. Okay, we want you to manage our servers, but you can't, you cannot have access to our servers. Just make sure they stay up and running, make sure they're patched and everything's cool with them. But by the way, you cannot look at any data whatsoever on any of our boxes. You know, when your IT guy comes to install software, he can't install software. You have to use, you know, our lawyer guy that sits over here, Mike, who is a lawyer, but he also knows something about computers. We had a department like that there, and that was a requirement. So it should be able to work on essentially what are unmanaged boxes, where you can say, okay, well, computer comes up, I've got to be able to sniff the wire, get the credentials, and say, okay, you can get to these things that you want. Basically, you have to be able to work without an agent on the device. Okay? That's what it comes down to. Or use what's referred to as dissolvable agent, where they, like, say, go to a web page and they download this thing that runs and make sure they're compliant with policy, they got their antivirus, et cetera, and then deletes itself from memory. Okay? And that was actually a big deal at our legal department there. It was a huge deal. They were even in their own separate building, you know, with their own. They had their own carded access. Even the carded access system was separate from the rest of the world. It was crazy stuff. The other thing is that the deployment should be seamless and it should be scalable. And that's always going to be a problem. That's a challenge that we face, every vendor faces, is especially the scalable one. You have to be able to deploy this in massively large infrastructures. And you should be able to do it without changing your infrastructure. You really don't want to be told, say, okay, we can put this solution in here. By the way, to do it, you're going to have to upgrade your routers, and the software is going to have to be, you know, version XYZ. And you think, well, our current hardware won't run that. Well, you're going to have to upgrade all your routers then, you know, to these massively bigger routers to be able to do the stuff that we need to do. No one's going to want to do that. You should be able just to be able to, you know, plug yourself in line in there and go. These are the main things that if you are looking for a NAC vendor, and this really will help you out if you don't want to do NAC and you've got a, you know, the CIO comes in and says, you know, I just talked to, you know, Bob's NAC company, and they said, hey, this stuff is great. Let's get some. Then you can go through a list and say, well, does it do this? Does it do this? It's not going to work. And here's one that may be part of the problem. Once NAC gets in the building, who owns it? Now, one would think, well, if it's touching all the desktops, because they've got to, you know, go through the whole policy thing, it's touching all the desktops, then maybe all the sysadmin should own it. But it's dealing with data transferring over the wire. Maybe it's the network guys. It's just the network guys that own it. And in a lot of cases, that can be quite a difference. I mean, are there people here that are like both sysadmins and kind of network guys both? Okay, we got a few. But a few people didn't raise their hands because they're probably possibly either one or the other. A lot of companies will separate, especially the larger companies, will separate those out into different departments. So I've actually seen people that say, okay, well, the sysadmins say we want to own the product. And then you have another group, the network guys say, no, it's, you know, we own what data goes on the wire. This is totally, you're putting it in line. You know, you're going to screw up our routers or something. I know you are. So we own it, not you. And believe it or not, I've even seen internal auditing is claiming that they own it because, hey, this thing deals with policy. And we're the policy guys. We want to be able to enforce policy. We want to own it. Okay? So this is kind of a dilemma within some companies, and it's actually held up sales. And we've had deals that have ended because they couldn't figure out internally who's going to run the damn thing once it got inside. You know, and the CIO throws up his hands and says, we're going to have to work this stuff out as to, and they end up like doing things like, well, you know, because this person said this and that person said that, we're now going to rewrite our entire policy. You know, because everyone got in a big argument and brought up that stupid shit that happened like, you know, months ago. You know, that when they got into the big fight over the last big piece of technology that came in. And so, you know, it just becomes a big mess. So we've actually seen that. All right. Assuming you get this stuff deployed, here are some issues, some kind of things that I want to kind of go through here. Adaptation by attackers. Now, I mainly deal at my company with the IPS component, so I'm all about, you know, the attackers and stuff like that. And my background's suited for it. Attackers will, as they become smarter, and when I say attacker, I'm not talking about, you know, a bunch of, you know, kids over in Russia or Taiwan or Romania or wherever they're at, you know, botnetting you. I'm talking about, it could be that as well. But I'm talking about, like, you know, contractors or, you know, those evil end users that we have to deal with. Those types of attackers that are going to be, you know, the tactics, they're going to consider, if there's knack there, ways to try to get around that and bypass it. Now, there's already security researchers that are starting to say, and I've seen these at a few security conferences, someone says, here's how to blow by, Cisco's NAC authentication thing by tricking it into saying that, oh, yes, I'm somebody else, or, oh, yes, it's okay for me to proceed, that kind of thing. So there's already that kind of stuff that's going on out there. Researchers are already starting to look at it. And, of course, all this information is public and everything, so attackers are certainly going to start to adapt some of those tactics. And the other thing is, there's always this kind of allowed by default thing that ends up biting you. And, you know, maybe printers are allowed by default to talk to the network because they're printers. They typically don't, I mean, in some cases they can, but typically they don't log in to the network. A lot of cases they just are. Or let's say that there may be a switch that you manage and you come in over an IP address. You don't want to have that IP address authenticate to the network. So you may have certain MAC addresses that you say, if I see these MAC addresses, I'm going to go ahead and allow them on the network. Well, anything that is allowed by default, that will be exploited. Okay? As one of the first things I did when I went to work at Vernier was figured out where the printers were, what they were, and just assigned myself, you know, did denial of service against the printer, knocked it offline, which wasn't hard, and then gave myself the printer's IP address and MAC address, and I'm on the network, and I can do whatever I want, and nobody's looking at me, and I'm you know, I can just go crazy. Now, obviously, you'd probably put a rule in that says my printers can't talk to, you know, the internet, or my printers can't do IRC or something. I mean, you're going to put something in there that would, you know, limit that from happening. Adaptation to new technology. And this is the other thing. It'll bite you in the butt if you buy some NAC solution and then something new comes along and the NAC device doesn't support it. So let's say that everyone is on, this is kind of funny, I was editing the slides earlier today and I saw that I'd actually typed in the sentence, everyone is on Windows and everything is great. And I thought, well, that may not necessarily hold true. Well, everyone is on Windows and they seem to be functioning as best they can while running Windows is probably what the sentence should read. But the thing is you've got everyone on one operating system, your NAC stuff works fine, everything else seems to be working fine, and then whammo, there's a merger, or you were acquired by somebody, or you acquire somebody, and all of a sudden you got all these weird things in there that you did, you know, like you're using Windows, you're using, you know, you're expecting Kerberos 5 type of stuff going on, and then whammo, all of a sudden it's LDAP, this other place uses LDAP, and they can't turn that stuff off because they've got applications that are logging in and doing things, and so they have to have LDAP. What if your solution doesn't support LDAP? Now what do you do? Now where do you go with this? And I use the term merger in here because it's very possible that might be one of these, that's going to be one of these things that legally upper management can't tell you, oh, we got a merger coming up, so make sure it supports, you know, these other things. They can't be doing that kind of stuff. This has happened before. There's also a new policy directive comes down. You know, the IT department has accounts on every box, and maybe it's for like you know remotely installing software or whatever, and you get dinged on some type of audit, or there's some type of regulation in whatever industry that you're in that says, and the auditor that's interpreting that says, okay, you got to kill this account because it violates all kinds of bad things. All of a sudden, you have to take that account off. So that means that you can't log in to do something on the box, and that will hurt you bad. I mean, can you use dissolvable agents? And again, can you use a dissolvable agent that'll run on Linux, that'll run on a Mac? You know, a lot of people will do stuff that'll run on Windows. But, you know, and that's what they'll do. I mean, you'll have these, it's funny because you'll have these salespeople will just say, well, just, you know, take the ActiveX object and, you know, run it on his Linux thing and we should be fine. It's like, well, no, it didn't quite work that way. So you have to make sure that whatever you get is going to be flexible, because this is a gotcha that can and will happen to people after they get this stuff in there. Policy compliance. Enforcing policy during authentication is going to be one thing, but there's kind of a pseudo buzzword in the NAC world. It's called post-authentication. You have to be able to do things post-authentication. So how do I enforce policy after they've authenticated on there? Typically what you're doing is that's where the whole idea of running an IPS that's tied into the whole system to kind of say, oh, and policy says you're not supposed to attack each other. Policy says you're not supposed to download spyware, right? And just all these different things, and you have, you know, these IPS-type signatures in there. Or it could be something as simple as saying, policy says you're not going to run peer-to-peer software, or you're not going to use Skype, or some other piece of software that's, you know, clearly against. Or this is a horrible one to write rules for. We got a request from marketing. They said, we want to allow instant messaging, but we want to disallow file transfer within instant messaging, because we want to make sure all documents coming in or out of the company go through the email gateway so they can get scanned. That's company policy. We want that to happen. So, but the thing is people do business using IM. Deals have been closed in IM. Okay, you have to end up allowing it. This way, at least, you know, you can say, okay, well, maybe the corporate standard is, okay, everyone can use, I don't know, let's say Yahoo IM. I'll allow Yahoo IM, I'll block all the other ones, and I'll block file transfer of Yahoo IM, that kind of thing. Those are the kinds of weird things that where you're enforcing policy post-authentication. These are things that are going to happen triggered off of end-user actions on those computers. You need to be able to kind of take a look at that kind of thing. That becomes kind of a big deal because, see, before, again, like I said, it gets back to that VP at the airport thing. You can't do things black and white. You can't just, because normally it would be just like, I'll just block access to, you know, 5050 or whatever it is that Yahoo IM runs on, and that'll stop file transfer. Oh, and you have to, oh, and also port 80, it'll run over port 80 as well. So block port 80, and you've turned off Yahoo file transfer. Although they may complain about access to a few other things if you do that. But nonetheless, you get the idea. So you should be able to selectively do that kind of thing. Alternate paths in. Now, this is kind of another gotcha is like if, I mean, there's... Mainly it's the road warriors that you have to worry about, because they may be coming in from all kinds of different places. You know, like for me, I'm always got the laptop, you know, with wireless on it. That's a big thing for me. using the VPN, whatnot, you have people that are going on customer sites and coming in and stuff, you still need to be able to deal with that. There are some solutions that aren't as good at dealing with what would be a mobile workforce. And so, you know, putting this technology in there and then not being able to support a mobile workforce is fairly brutal. Or some kind of odd thing you didn't consider, like dial-up. How many people here have dial-up? Okay, so there's still people that have it. How many people found out they have dial-up after an audit, but didn't know it before? Yeah, there we go. So we had someone, right? Yeah, it happens. Okay, contractors, guest workers, guests on your network for whatever reason. Typically, your policy is going to have something that's going to allow guests. A real common thing for guests especially is you may have kind of a guest group. Someone comes in, you say, okay, well, I'm going to give you an ID that'll at least allow you to authenticate onto the network. This is what you're going to have access to. You're going to be able to go to the internet, and you're going to be able to use one printer, and that's it. Okay, and that may be all that you want that guest to be able to do. You don't want that guest, you know, poking around on your network because they're behind the firewall and things aren't maybe as protected as they should be. And the other thing is you may have, like, say, contractors or other people coming in over a VPN link that are coming into your network, say from a trusted, your biggest client or some big supplier that you're dealing with, and you got these people coming in over a VPN link. A lot of times, probably because, you know, you guys are showing up to a conference and you're trying to learn more and know more, I'm going to bet that your guys' security policy at your company is probably better than the security policy at that big client or big vendor, you know, where they've just got all kinds of massive crap coming in there. What the hell's leaking in over my VPN link with this supposedly trusted vendor or whatever? So it kind of helps, particularly if you're able to say, okay, well, I'm going to be able to, you know, constrain and only allow them to do these certain types of things, including down to a level of saying, you know, they can talk to the web server and they can, but I'm still going to look at their traffic so they don't, you know, try to do, you know, who knows, cross-site scripting, whatever it is they try to do, pop the box, throw shell code at it and do crazy stuff. And of course, in light of this, you still need to have all the perimeter technology that is still required. There still end up maybe being holes inside your file server. You still have to consider the fact that the mail server has got crap coming in as well. Antivirus is good, and it catches a lot of stuff. It doesn't necessarily catch everything. So you have to kind of look at these kind of alternate paths. Right now, like the really big thing that's going on right now in the attacker world is client-side attacks. You know, because firewalls have been put in place, and, you know, attackers have figured out, okay, well, a request goes out to some web server. And if I'm an attacker and I'm somewhere in the path, I don't even have to control that web server, okay? If I'm somewhere in the path of that, let's say I'm able to do, like, the whole, BGP, you know, throw things over to where I can now get to the data that's going out. I can be the so-and-so server at that time. And then just say, okay, you requested index.html. Guess what? Here's some nice code for your browser. Has nothing to do with what you requested. But I was an attacker somewhere in the path, and I'm shoveling that stuff down back at that client. You have to keep in mind that that is an alternate path into your network. Now, it's not necessarily one that you're even allowing, per se. I mean, you are allowing web traffic out and responses to come back in. Those are part of established TCP connections. but that is a path in to your network. And you have to keep that in mind. And I know this, you know, because I kind of paint kind of a bleak picture here with, you know, and but you guys are living this, so you kind of know that, you know, for the most part, I used to talk about perimeters. I did this talk about, I don't know, originally probably 6 or 7 years ago, and I was talking about how I used this quote of Frank Zappa. Frank Zappa had a quote that he said that modern jazz isn't dead, it just smells funny. And so I used to say perimeter security isn't dead, it just smells funny. At this point, I would say perimeter security is dead. Okay, there are way, way too many ways to get into an environment at this point, between client-side attacks, you know. And that's the thing. I mean, you can go in there and send out that email to everyone in the company and say, there's this virus going around. There's going to be an EXE attached to it. It's going to say happybirthday.exe. Do not double-click on it. And people will still double-click on it. Oh, yeah, I got one of those. I clicked on it. What should I do? They will every single time, okay? The whole whack-a-mole thing. People want to whack the mole. They do. They will do stupid, stupid stuff. It really is amazing anyone gets anything done at all with that kind of attitude. All right, next steps. Now, this is kind of a section where I'm really going to kind of start to kind of lay into NAC vendors. And you can apply this to the company I work for as well. That's fine. Okay? Post-authentication, the user could be doing bad things. Now, any time that you're relying upon code, whether it's code that is like an agent that's on the end user system, or even dissolvable agents, it is possible to lie to that code. Okay? If all that code does to see if you're compliant, let's say it's checking to see if your antivirus is up to date on some Windows system. If all it's doing is going to a registry location and checking that date, anything could have put that there. Okay? So you can lie and make yourself compliant. And that means you as malicious code, you as disgruntled user, you as stupid user who's smart enough to do this kind of crap, you know, you can lie to the code that checks your system for compliance. It can happen. And this is another one. I can authenticate as a Windows user but then I can log in with take that IP address that just got authenticated and that MAC address, and then come in running Linux and then do whatever it is I need to do. Okay? That's another way. I mean, I've actually done this on our stuff. Okay? Mainly because we don't have policies in place that are gonna like look for the telltale signs of Linux and kill it. In fact, almost all of our development is done on Linux. But nonetheless, the thing is I can take, you know, a pristine image of XP that's 100% perfect, which the corporation expects, and then use that to authenticate, and then just take that address and then do something else with it. And the thing I mentioned earlier, the whole, you know, login as the printer kind of thing, that still works. And again, the thing is to be effective, you have to be in line. You should be in the core. You need a presence at the perimeter. You need to be everywhere, because you have to be between every single user and every single resource that they may try to access from that computer. The thing that is really hard is because in a lot of cases you cannot control user-to-user stuff. Like if one user starts attacking another user, unless it hits one of those devices that's looking for this stuff, or this controlling access to that stuff, it can be a problem. That's a challenge for everyone, including Vernier. We have a tendency to have issue with this particular one, because you can't be everywhere at once. Okay, this is a biggie. NAC controls accesses to network resources. It does not control access to applications and data that are independent of servers. Okay? So if you're moving data around or you're collecting data from 8 or 9 different points, it can't go in there, and you can't put in ACLs that say, Bob can't access this data. Okay, you're saying is Bob can't access this server or these servers or this port on this server. That's all you're doing. You're not saying Bob can't access this data. And there's an extreme level of distinction there, because if all of your custom apps are all running on web servers on port 80, or you've got a bunch of custom apps running on one web server via port 80, then this is not going to be able to control access to individual applications on that server. You're still going to rely on whatever's on that server. There are people that expect that out of their NAC stuff, and it's not there. It's really not. And there's more. I couldn't get all this on one slide, which is kind of sad. Tunneling bypasses virtually all vendors. Okay? Any variation on Wi-Fi types of bypassing, the little tricks that you do to not pay for T-Mobile, okay, by tunneling everything over DNS, which works quite well, actually. Okay? That works with all the NAC vendors, because essentially that's what the wireless is. It's a form of NAC. So if your users know how to not pay for T-Mobile when they're at Starbucks, then they know how to bypass your NAC. Granted, they're probably not going to be running their own rogue DNS server inside your environment, although I guess that could happen. But nonetheless, if they got that, if you're saying the users can't access crap at home, and they can if they can tunnel out on a DNS. So that's that was really funny too, because they were asking about when I was at work one day, they were talking about stuff, and I said, "Oh yeah, you can get around everything by doing that." I said, "I never pay for wireless," and I kind of bragging and being all bravado, whatever. And so they said, "Okay, well, let's see you do it. Let's put your money where your mouth is." So, I got my laptop hooked up to a screen like this, and so, I fire up Dan Kaminsky's that Aussie man stuff, and so, and off I go. I connect up to the server, and of course, I have port 22 set to certain ranges, so it's not open to the world, but nonetheless. Up comes my custom, profanity-based banner in front of, most of the executive staff, and I was kind of, you will do what with a broken bottle? That was kind of embarrassing. But nonetheless, you can get around. I think we have a workaround for at least one or two of those. And like Dan's stuff, there's actually a signature that you could write to detect the fact that it's Dan's stuff, because he leaves some stuff specifically in there for whatever reason. But nonetheless, you can, so, and I'm surprised people like T-Mobile and Wayport. Do we have anyone here that works for T-Mobile or Wayport? Okay, good. All right. Used to? Okay, don't tell them. Don't tell them. But nonetheless, maybe they're tunneling ICMP, just whatever. If it's allowed, they can get out. If the goods are in data, then ACLs are going to mean absolutely nothing. Absolutely at all. Okay, now here's the scenario. And this was one that, when I worked at the railroad, convinced the, believe it or not, we had a CIO that said, "Hey, we're the railroad. We have to share, according to regulations, we got to share all of our stuff, our rates and everything with all these other railroads. We got to share it with the Department of Transportation. Why do we need passwords at all? Why don't we save this money on password resets and just get rid of all passwords?" Okay? And he was dead serious. Okay, say nothing of the fact that, I could log in as him, and give myself a raise. But anyway, that was this was the scenario that we used for that. And it was like, okay. And I went in, and I didn't know much about this, but I was able to ask around enough in the company, and I found out the exact bits of data that I needed to pull out of the data warehouse. And using just basically guest-type access, I was able to pull down enough bits from the data warehouse to construct a daily cash flow sheet on the company. So now I know exactly where sales are, where everything's heading, and I can trend it. And so at that point, I can start doing insider trading on a huge scale because I know exactly where everything is. And you know, the fact that I'm pulling all this information, I'm saying, look, anybody in the company, we just deployed the DB2 client on every single workstation because of all these goofy custom apps. So it's all there. Everyone in the company now has the capability of insider trading. And you don't want to use passwords on this stuff? I said, it's nuts. I said, it's bad enough. You know, see, at least with passwords, we know which guy's doing it. You know, which guy is logging into the system. Particularly if it's like, off hours or something like that. But the whole thing is that we had no way to be able to differentiate, because, Bob may have legitimate access to these eight elements here. And on occasion, the applications that he used may need to have legitimate access to these objects over here. But if Bob is able to pull these together, he may be able to do something kind of bad. NAC doesn't take care of that scenario at all. In fact, nothing takes care of that scenario at all. There's really no way to prevent that. I mean, if he has legitimate access to the data and he's able to make, some type of correlation out of this data, there's nothing you can do about it. The other one is like you have a couple of users. I have Alice and Bob here in accounting. And they have this basically the same profile. They, they're able to access these resources. They can't access others and whatnot. Can you tell which one of them is looking at data they shouldn't be looking at? Okay, all the data resides on the same servers. It's all, for the most part, it's roughly the same applications and stuff. How do we know one of them's looking at data they shouldn't be? Can you judge it on the amount of data they're looking at? Well, maybe not necessarily. Maybe they both look at a ton of data. Okay, there's really, how can we do that? NAC doesn't take care of this. Okay, so don't let any NAC vendor, including one of our salespeople, ever tell you that, we're going to, 100% secure data and, everything will be fine and you'll be the hero of your company and, all that other crap that marketing people tell you. All right, where things are headed. And you have to be able to, and this is in general, this is what's becoming, I think is becoming obvious, not just to some of the more, major forward-thinking players in NAC, but also for a lot of other people as well, and that is you have to be able to identify more than users. You need to identify what applications they use, and you need to be able to identify the data that they access. Okay? Now, yes, that does sound kind of big brotherish, but that's what it boils down to. If you're expected to protect company resources and protect data and protect company assets, this is what it comes down to. For the most part, a company's main assets are going to be somewhere in that data. They're not going to be the server that the data resides on. Okay, it's the actual information itself. And that's really what, because we're all already about protecting that data. This is just another way of going out and protecting that data. So there has to be a way to be able to differentiate, Bob accessing the server, he's using these types of applications, and he's looking at this type of data. Is that allowed? Is that not allowed? Is this normal for Bob to do? Is this abnormal for Bob to do? Did Bob switch jobs? Bob's now working in payroll instead of, purchasing. Okay, then maybe it's okay. Maybe it's not. What if Bob is working in payroll, but he's acting on occasion like someone that's working in purchasing? that in itself might be kind of something you may want to know about. That's the kind of thing where we seem to be kind of heading. And so what happens is there should be the ability to limit network resources, and it's based upon layered profiles. So it has to be based upon, you know, a profile for user identity coupled with not only just application usage, but data usage within that application. That seems to be kind of the direction that we're talking. And that's why I found like the autonomic networking stuff fairly interesting, because in a way that's kind of the direction that's kind of heading as well. I mean, they're getting farther and farther along to where you're not just looking at, I'm looking at config files. I want to be able to push them out to 500 machines. I want it done automated. Maybe this system can say, oh, look, there's a problem here. I'm going to auto-correct this on all these servers. Take care of it for me. And it may be like minor stuff that or whatever, but that seems to be kind of a direction we're heading. This kind of ties into that whole same scenario, where there's more of a focus of just looking beyond just identifying the user on the network, and even identifying their data stream, what's inside that data stream. Correlation of events. There should be a way to be able to correlate on the back end a lot of these events. You know, if Bob is, you know, doing his thing in accounting, and he's fine, that's great. But if all of a sudden, if Bob's computer, we really don't know if it's Bob or Bob's computer, but if Bob's computer is simultaneously having a massive conversation with some systems in Romania at the same time he's doing a normal accounting work, then that might be interesting to know. Now, the thing is if we are able to go back and correlate using events, and we see that at 3 o'clock in the morning, when only the janitor was in the building, that all of a sudden Bob's computer accessed a porn site somewhere, then maybe we can start putting events together. You know, that's the kind of correlation I'm talking about. Things that actually kind of help direct you to say, hey, look, we had some odd things that happened involving Bob's computer. And it would be nice someday in the future to be able to say, okay, there's something wrong with Bob. Right-click on Bob and, you know, on the GUI map, and it says, here's weird things that Bob's computer's done lately. And even to the point saying, okay, Bob logged into these 8 different machines because, you know, it's this weirdo corporate environment where they're doing some type of, you know, cubicle sharing thing. Anyone doing this where they have, like, cubicle sharing? I know of a couple of companies that do this where, where just, like, the employee that shows up first gets to pick which cube, and you basically just sit wherever you want. Maybe it's shift work.
Flex space.
There you go. Flex space. You don't work at Travelocity, do you? Yeah, he works at Travelocity. That's where I've heard the term, flex space. I'd forgotten that. Yeah, but they'll do that. Companies will do that, or they'll work like when I was at the railroad. We had shift work, okay, where you had you have these guys that are running the railroad. They're like, you know, traffic control for railroads. You don't want to build this knock for them that's like 3 times larger than it has to be. Yeah, it's got to be staffed 7x24. Okay, and they work 3 shifts, 8-hour shifts, and these guys also, they're union, okay? So there's no, everything's all rigid and controlled, and that's what happens, is there may be 3 different people that use that computer over the course of a 24-hour period. So, and of course, you know, if they come in early and, you know, this guy for some reason is working a double for whoever knows why, and by the way, that never happened at the railroad, okay? But nonetheless, if someone was doing that, it says, well, I got to go over to this machine to log in. That's what they do. So to be able to correlate events is a real biggie. Automation of reaction to events. Now, this can be everything from like your typical, you know, IPS type behavior to being able to say, okay, well, I need to, you know, shut down certain services on, you know, Bob's computer, or I need to, you know, maybe I'm going to, you know, restrict his access to things except to, you know, just, you know, 1 or 2 devices that'll at least keep him pseudo-functional, You know, there's all kinds of things that can happen there. Or like, you know, dispatch the, you know, release the hounds on Bob or, you know, whatever it needs to be. Well, maybe that might be a bad thing to end up getting hacked is someone figures out a way to open the gate for the dogs and say, go get Bob. You know, but nonetheless, I mean, something that would, you know, there's going to be a reaction to those events. It's going to be automated in some form or fashion. I think that's obvious. That's where we're heading. For minor things, you know, restarting services or, like I said, correcting flaws in the fly that are very minor and whatnot. That'll probably happen more and more. Okay, and obviously this is not NAC that I'm talking about at this point. This is something that's much broader. It's much bigger. It's not something that you can go out and it's not, you know, like, I mean, yeah, there's it deals with things like, you know, net flows and things like that. It deals with, you know, identity on the network. It deals with such things as, you know, application identification. It pulls all these elements together. That's roughly where we're headed. And it's a fascinating area to play around in from a researcher, from my perspective, because it's completely virgin territory from a security standpoint. You know, because I get to think of ways to try to bypass that. You know, like how do I get onto a network where all network traffic is being monitored? How do I now compromise other computers? How do I now look like legitimate traffic to get from system to system as an intruder? Or just to do in general bad things like, you know, how am I going to get the, you know, that those numbers I need to do the insider trading? How am I going to do that? All right. So we're kind of at the end here. And we can open up to Q&A. Like I said, you can ask me about the NAC stuff. You can ask me about all these different kinds of things dealing with what we've talked about so far. Or you can ask about something else. That's fine. But and you can reach me. I got a couple email addresses here. The presentation, I uploaded it just a few minutes ago. So if you need a copy of the slides for whatever reason, there's the link to go grab it. And I really hope it's there. I tried it and something came up saying you're about to download something. And so, so something's there. That probably sounds really evil. I'm not doing a client-side attack on you guys, okay? You'll have to trust me on that. So, anyway, any questions? Anyone got any questions or comments or whatever? I think they want you to go to the mic because they're recording. They should be on. Well, just ask your question.
Yeah.
I'll repeat it. Okay, so the question was the opinion on signature-based IDSs. And we'll go ahead and throw an IPS in there, too, because it's more or less the same thing, except it's what? Oh, yeah, it kills things, yeah. So it actually destroys the stream or whatever. My opinion on them is that they kind of suck. And I actually do, and you know, you can quote me on that. I actually have a whole presentation that I do on just that topic. And I'm not going to go through it now, but nonetheless, I mean, the problem with it is this, and that is, okay, how many people here have run Snort? Okay, the whole room just about runs Snort. I mean, running it now, like production runs Snort. Two or three brave people. The people that are running it now in production, are you running it in tandem with a commercial-based IDS IPS system? Okay, all right, okay. How many people are running a commercial-based IDS IPS system? How many people, okay, all right, a couple of Snort guys may know where I'm going. How many people are running just more than one IDS IPS system simultaneously? Okay. Got a few people that actually are. That's almost the direction you have to go. If you're going to do that, get the professional one that cost a mint, that has the horrible interface and the unbelievably shitty licensing scheme that milks you for all kinds of stuff because they do a lot of good coverage. And then you complement that with Snort. Okay? I wouldn't necessarily recommend the bleeding Snort or the bleeding edge rules wholeheartedly, simply because you'll get bitten by them a little bit, a lot of false positives and that kind of thing. Essentially, those are like you become a beta tester for a rule doing that, because they haven't gone through a lot of QA on those. The other thing that's interesting about rules-based stuff is there are a lot of commercial vendors of IDS equipment that, under the hood, it's Snort, okay? But they're calling it, you know, Fred's IDS. We're Fred's IDS Corp, and we sell this wondrous device that you can't have access to, and you plug it into your network, and what's under the hood is Snort, and the rules that are coming in there are Snort. There is more than one vendor that does nothing but write signatures for security vendors to load into their product, which they can then sell. So that way you have the vendor doesn't even have to develop the signatures. They're just selling you basically a PC, a rack mount PC with an in and an out. And, you know, and they may have probably a web-based, GUI to kind of control it and everything. And that's what's happening. And so what happens is you are entirely dependent upon one of two vendors for the quality of their signatures. Now, as a person that went through there and evaluated four different companies that sold this service, just to see how good their signatures were, we're at Vernier, we're doing this. We do outsource signatures. But the thing is, when we get them in-house, we also do some QA on them and make sure they actually work. And we may have to supplement them because they didn't cover things well. And I'm not necessarily going to tell them, hey, you wrote this signature wrong, because if they fix it, then they fix all my competitors' signatures as well. You know what I mean? I mean, if it's something really bad that's going to, like, make people get owned, then I'm going to be nice and say, hey, look, you need to fix this because this isn't doing anything. But nonetheless, I mean, on some of the smaller stuff, I'll let it go. Or if I'm busy, I'm going to let it go. And so what happens is you have all these boxes out there that may or may not be of very high quality as far as signatures go. You have to do a combination of not just signature-based, but anomaly detection. Okay, it has to be a combination of the two. You can't do one or the other. And so if you have a company that says, oh, we don't use signatures because they're bad. We use anomaly stuff. We're using heuristics. You know, that's another, you know, real fun one that they tell you. Okay, they're missing stuff. All right? The signature people are missing stuff as well. And it's so bad in the signature writing arena that, and this is the presentation I do has to do with being able to fingerprint an IDS IPS system by throwing old attacks that should be patched or variations of an attack that I know that some of these vendors that supply signatures wrote correctly and some of them did not. You can actually figure out the exact model of what IDS IPS vendor is. Yeah, I mean, you have to control some IP addresses that are unallocated and the DNS that's doing the reverse lookup and a little bit of patience, but you can do it. It can be done, and you can say, ah, well, they're running Fred's IDS. And I know that Fred's IDS does not cover, out of these 20 things I think might be interesting to hit this company with, I know that they don't cover number 11, 12, 13, 14, and 15. So when I start my attack, I'm not going to start at number 1 because they've got a rule for that. I'm going to start at 11. You know, so they're, you know, and by the way, this little technique I'm talking about of fingerprinting them, you know where I first heard about this? It was on a IRC server that's no longer there, but it was based in Russia. And it was a pretty seedy little neighborhood that these guys talked about this kind of stuff, and that they were doing this. And they had access to all kinds of dark IP space to do these, to forge their packets from. So, I mean, this is, you know, it's the state of signature-based stuff is pretty bad. I don't have a high opinion of them, even though I work for a vendor that does it. And that's why you, like I said, that's why you have to do both. And it was really, really painful, and you have to do some type of normalization of data before you even apply the signature to it. Like I said, I mean, like, anyone here familiar with the Metasploit framework? Okay, few people are. If you don't know what that is, you need to go look up, I think it's just metasploit.com, and go there and look for the framework. It's mainly meant as a framework for developing rapid development of exploits. But the thing is, like it has a bunch of anti-IDS, IPS type stuff built into a lot of it. So like if it's doing a client-side attack and it's sitting there sniffing, waiting for your victim to make a web request to anywhere, doesn't matter where, anywhere, it will answer back and it'll throw down this thing. And one of the things it does to evade IDS is that it gzips the payload, because that's normal for web stuff. Okay, a web server can gzip its stuff to, you know, save on bandwidth before it downloads it, and clients automatically un-gzip this stuff. Okay, and the whole idea behind gzipping it is that it allows you to bypass the IDS. So I mean, like, you know, the engineers at Vernier were not, they thought I was nuts. It says we need to be able to un-gzip on the fly. And they're like, what? That's stupid, you know? It's not going to happen. It's like, look, here's a tool that does this automatically. We got to do it. You know, and so at least the data's been somewhat, you know, what I call normalized, where at least it's in a format where a signature can take a look at it. Forget about all the random white space and everything else that's in there, and JavaScript obfuscation and all this other kind of stuff that's going on. Try to hide it. There is occasionally stuff in there that's going to be, has to be pseudo plain English that you can at least get some type of handle on. So you got to try to normalize as much stuff as possible before you even apply the signature, and then hope you got the signature right. So it's brutal. It is really, really brutal. And again, I mean, the best advice I have for people that are using IDS is I say, look, if you got the commercial one, great. You know, get a good one, get a name brand one, get Juniper's, whatever they have, and then couple that with Snort to kind of back it up. That way you've got at least two different things, at least Snort's free, and now you've got two different things looking at it. Or if you got, you know, boatloads of cash, then get two big commercial ones. So I guess if you're military, then you could probably do that. Another question. Another comment. Uh-oh.
So you mentioned earlier on that the system you use is based, can or cannot have agents on clients. Right, so there's a way around having an agent. So a couple of questions. One is, if you don't have an agent, you have to then download something that's going to execute it. And the other is, maybe you don't need anything at all. And you say, you know, look at the screen.
Okay, don't let me forget these. The question is about agents first, agent versus agentless, and if you're going agentless, you still have to have some type of code that gets downloaded and executes on the system. This is the classic dissolvable agent thing. Ideally, it would be probably something, you know, probably Java-based, because usually most clients are going to have some ability to execute Java on them, whether they're Unix-based, Mac, Windows, whatever. So that should be able to work. And yeah, you can still lie to those things if you know what they're going to look for. Okay? So if you've really picked apart, say, okay, well, I know it's going to look for these eight items, and these are things as me, the evil attacker type guy, can put in there, then great. Now, that's a lot of reverse engineering, particularly on a non Windows thing. Usually the Windows ones are pretty pathetic. They basically just, they just look at the registry entries, you know, and so they'll trust whatever is put into that, into the registry. Oh, it's updated because it said so in this text field, you know, which, by the way, has read-write access to anyone that logs into it, you know, including the end user that may be sitting there. So, yeah, I mean, that's it's not great, but, I mean, that's you are still executing code on there. Now, you can just say, okay, I am just going to do nothing but watch the traffic, okay? And in some cases, that may be what it comes down to. A really paranoid legal department might say, we're not even going to do the dissolvable agents because you IT people are nuts and, you know, you have long hair and you're creepy and, you know, you hang out in weird places and drink exotic beers and we don't trust you at all. So, exactly. So, I mean, that's, you know, they may have, you may not even be able to do that much. Then all you can do is just watch the data. Now, as far as like SSH, again, you're correct. I mean, yeah, there's been some papers written on traffic analysis to where my favorite one was one of the most common things that an admin does after he SSHs in is he's either, it probably does like, you know, an SU space dash enter. Okay, that's a key sequence. It's going to have a certain type of timing. And in SSH, this is going to be like, you know, one packet per letter. So I should be able to figure out, this just based on timing alone, I should be able to say, all right, he's SUing to root. And then I should be at that point be able to, you know, see the series of characters go by and then a pause where he hit enter. So now I know exactly how many keystrokes make up his root password. Like, okay, he's got an 8-character root password. Now, if I wanted to go gonzo nuts, I could compare timings and then start thinking about the mapping of those keys on the keyboard and whatnot, and then compare that to perhaps other admins logging in or previous times he's logged in, and perhaps I could actually figure out what the password was. But that's just the password, so we're probably not going to be able to get anything useful out of doing analysis on the SSH session. The only other things you could do at that point, this is where the whole future, like, say, correlation steps in. And really, I mean, you can't really do all this stuff just network only. You're going to have something on that box that's being able to provide some type of feedback. You know, maybe it's syslogging off somewhere, and you're able to look at that and, you know, see, okay, so-and-so, you know, yeah, I see the authentication. Yes, he ran sudo, and he ran these commands or whatever. Or maybe he did a sudo dash s, and now I'm lost. I don't know what he's doing. You know, you should be able to see something happen from there, or a lack of something, maybe another thing. I mean, you can take it to you know, massive extremes, but there you have it. Okay, well, there you go. Another question. Okay. The question was pushing things out from, you know, being in line and trying to see everything to try to push things out. He was talking about specifically, you know, low-jacking the laptop or whatever, where you can get down there to the NIC, basically, and see everything. There's only two ways to do this and do it right. You have to be in line everywhere, or you have to be on every single machine. Okay, now if you're on every single machine, you've got a whole new set of problems because now you've got a deployed agent everywhere. And maybe you even have a hardware-type device like you're talking about, just some type of dongle that you put on there. The dongle's going to be less likely to be hacked. But nonetheless, I mean, that's an interesting idea right there in itself. Can I put a piece of hardware you know, can I attach a piece of hardware to all these things? It's going to do some type of, you know, reconnaissance, you know, phone home with interesting data or whatnot. Or, you know, or even, you know, try to, you know, maybe there's something I can use that the machine spits out on its own. I've been looking at, I mean, people do, I don't know how many people are familiar with the tool called Poof, written by Michal Zalewski. It's basically passive OS identification based upon characteristics in TCP, you know, with various flags and stuff may be set on various types of packets. And so I can say, that's a Linux device. That's FreeBSD. That's, you know, whatever it is that they're, you know, whatever they got put into that database. I think it's possible to do that at an application level to a certain extent. I mean, I wrote a bunch of signatures that fingerprint telnet sessions, and they fingerprint so I can identify what the client is. Because a FreeBSD client, the initial packet, because it's got all that telnet negotiation crap, which, you know, is real goofy and screwbally. There's like differences between that, Windows 2000 and NT look a certain way, XP in 2003 look a different way. I mean, they all have different options that are set a different way, and you can. And so it's just like, you know, what can I do with that amount of data? Like, if I have a workstation that authenticates onto the network as a Windows device, and I see a Linux 2.6 kernel telnet come out of that device, that's a red flag. There's something going on. You know, I don't know whether they're natting for someone else in their cube or another computer in their cube. They've switched the devices around, or it's a VM. You know, if it's okay to do that kind of thing, fine. And maybe in some environments it'd be expected if the guy's running a bunch of VMs because that's part of his job. But in other areas it wouldn't be. So I mean, I would think there's got to be a way to at least try to fingerprint applications, and perhaps even go further and you know, based upon the data that's inside those applications. When I was at BindView, we worked there, I wanted, because we had code that we would put on every box in some cases, depending on what product you bought. And I was saying, oh my God, this is great, let's put a sniffer in there so we can gather data and do stuff with it. You know, we could say, okay, well, this guy's running IE version bad. Okay, he needs to upgrade. And we didn't have to do anything except because he's sniffing his neighbor's traffic. Just give me a presence on every, you know, just about everywhere we can, and you can actually see this stuff. These people are running bad versions of applications, or he's, you know, an old version of a corporate app, for example. You know, if you start building that kind of stuff into the application itself, it becomes really handy a way to track that. But I don't know if I'm kind of. Gumstick hardware, yes, Gumstick hardware, yeah.
You get an RJ45 and a USB on that, you power up a USB, you need an RJ45, you have an intelligent device that you can update. So that was where I was thinking that, you know, you could launch all of your queries and everything from there, have your little JVM in there for actually doing the state, you know, after your initial logging and something. That was my thought.
Well, yeah, and that's yet another way of doing it. It's a way of pushing out essentially what is the and the thing is, it would scale well because it's only got to handle one box, you know. Now you got to buy a gajillion of them because you got like all kinds of devices in your network. I know at the railroad we had like, you know, I think 30,000 employees and 200,000 network devices, you know we had a couple of fully populated public class Bs, and we had a dot 10 or a 10 dot that was like filled, and we had 151 dot class A that was filled, or 150. I probably shouldn't be giving these IP addresses out. I don't work there anyway anymore. But the 10 dot's okay? Oh, do we have someone from the railroad here? No, he's not going to admit to it. I can neither confirm nor deny. Okay. Anything else? Just throw them out, All right, well, I guess that's it. Thanks a lot for coming to the talk. And, if you have anything that you want to ask but not yell it out in front of an audience, you can come up here, or I'll be around tomorrow. If you see me walking around, just grab me and say hey. So anyway, thanks. Appreciate it.